Hi, listeners. I've got a couple of questions for you before we begin today's program. First, do you like Undisclosed? I'm gonna imagine that you do because you're listening to it. Okay, so second, do you like that Undisclosed is a free podcast? Would you like to help keep Undisclosed a free podcast? Me too. Here's how we're gonna do it. You gotta support our sponsors. The way this thing works is sponsors give us the money that we need to produce two pieces of long-form content each week that we give to you for free. In return, we ask that you check out those sponsors and, if you like their products, purchase them using an undisclosed promo code or URL. The sponsors see this and they're like, wow, Undisclosed is a really great podcast to sponsor because their fans come and buy our products. Let's do it again. Then the sponsors give us money. We use that money to make Undisclosed. You buy things from the sponsors. Rinse, wash, repeat, ad infinitum. So again, you like that Undisclosed is free, right? So go check out our sponsors and help keep Undisclosed free. With that in mind, Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 11 is brought to you by Third Love, Framebridge, and Blue Apron. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that. Research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
Fifteen minutes after we finished recording this episode, a surprise landed in the Undisclosed inbox. A whole bunch of new files from the Baltimore Police Department's investigation into Freddie Gray's death. Now, we had requested many of these files from BPD through our original MPIA request, but we were denied because of the ongoing Department of Justice investigation. So, we tried another route. We filed another MPIA with the state's attorney's office for many of those same records. And guess what? They just delivered. Now, we still don't have absolutely everything that we'd like, but we have a lot more than we did before. And much of what's inside these new files fits with what our own investigation has revealed. We are still trying to figure out how to share the new information that should have appeared in earlier episodes, and it certainly further strengthens the rest of our episodes in this series, but don't worry, you're not going to miss out on anything. We will update you with any new information that we find. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, and as always, I'm here with my colleagues Amelia McDonald-Perry, Justine Barron, and Dr. Marcia Chatlin. And this week, we talk about the autopsy.
There's one thing that every medical expert who's assessed Freddie Gray's neck injury can agree on. Had he survived, he would have been quadriplegic. At the trials of the police officers charged in his death, the medical experts debated through their testimonies whether his injury was, quote, catastrophic versus, quote, progressive. But all would no doubt agree that even in the best case scenario, the impact of his injury on his life would have been nothing less than catastrophic, and any progress wouldn't have been an improvement. Without the use of his arms, legs, and torso, the rest of Freddie's life would have been incomprehensibly difficult, especially without the money and resources to access the quality 24-hour health care that irreversible spinal cord injuries require. What the experts don't agree on is how and when Freddie Gray sustained his fatal injury, or how rapidly his symptoms would have deteriorated. As with everything in this case, there are no easy answers to the question, how was Freddie Gray killed?
Autopsies can tell us a lot about how, when, and why a person died. But autopsies don't tell us everything about the ways that people lived, or rather, what they are forced to live with because they are poor, or because they are black, or because they lived in Baltimore. For Freddie, like many of his neighbors and friends in Sandtown, lead, or rather lead paint, shaped the course of his physical health, his academic performance, and his family's financial stability. Lead, a naturally occurring element, was considered a wonder element throughout the world, and it was used to make stained glass, it was used in the production and sweetening of alcohol, to build printing presses, to make bullets, to make cosmetics shine, and eventually glossy paints. Although there has been knowledge of lead poisoning and lead blindness for centuries, it wasn't until the 20th century when bans on lead paint and eventually leaded fuel came into effect. And today, we are all too aware of the dangers of lead to water supplies, as cities like Flint, Michigan still wait for lead pipes to be replaced and a return to a clean public water source. Although Freddie was born in 1989, 11 years after the U.S. government issued a federal ban on consumer use of the once popular lead paint, he lived in a home that had not been stripped of this toxic threat. So chipping paint settled on the floor of his early childhood home on North Carey Street. His family and friends remembered the dusting of lead paint that settled onto the furniture and on top of toys. Toddlers are especially vulnerable to lead paint poisoning because when they put paint chips in their mouths, it tastes sweet, so they tend to sample more. Lead poisoning is especially harmful to children, and according to medical researchers, every internal organ is affected and harmed by lead. Most significant of all, a child's brain and its development. In 1979, child psychiatrist Herbert Needleman was the first to warn that even low levels of lead exposure can have high-stakes impacts on children. The impact of lead-based brain damage continues as a child matures, and lead has been linked to behavioral problems, difficulties with learning, issues involving impulse control, and stunted motor development. Severe lead poisoning leads to endless seizures and the swelling of the brain, which all can lead to an early death. Terrence McCoy in the Washington Post chronicled the ways that lead paint impacted Freddie and his family. Freddie's family pursued a lead paint lawsuit and reached a settlement in 2010. In the deposition, Freddie recounted his challenges at school and his twin sister Frederica's emotional problems. In August of 2015, McCoy exposed the way that Freddie's family lost a significant amount of their settlement to Access Funding LLC, a structured settlement company that offers pennies on the dollar deals to families that have received restitution but cannot access the award at once or in a way that allows them to support themselves and their families. So in return for lump sum cash payments, they sell future dollars to Access and other companies like them. McCoy reported that Freddie sold, quote, $146,000 worth of his structured settlement, valued at $94,000, to Access Funding for around $18,300. His sisters also exchanged $435,000 of the Gray sibling settlement, valued at around $280,000, for about $54,000, or less than 20 cents on the dollar of its present day value. McCoy concluded, taken together, the sample shows Access Funding petitioned to buy roughly $6.9 million worth of future payments, which had a present value of $5.3 million, for around $1.7 million. Access Funding is currently being sued by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau for deceptive practices involving settlement awardees. In a November 2016 press release about the case, the Protection Bureau characterized Access as orchestrating an illegal scheme in which victims of lead paint poisoning and others were deceived into signing away future settlement payments in exchange for a significantly lower lump sum payout. Freddie's poisoning and the predatory practices of the structured settlement agreements his family found themselves subject to remind us how little justice there can be in corners and sections of the U.S., in which the color of your skin, how much money you have or don't have, and what kind of housing you inhabit determines how you live and how you die.
Well, what we do know for sure is that he was in good health when the police first contacted him. and he died of an 80% severed spinal cord and three broken vertebrae in his neck.
Is that what doctors
and
have told
that's not
you?
Good.
Is that where are you getting that information, Mr. Murphy?
We have our own sources at this point, and we're not at liberty to expose those sources, but I'm confident that that information is reliable. Mm-hmm. Now, bear in mind that Baltimore has a sorry history of police brutality and an even sorrier history in terms of a governmental response to police brutality. Typically, the police deny, 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 no matter what the facts are.
This is William Billy Murphy Jr., a well-known Baltimore civil rights attorney who represents the Gray family, speaking on CNN the day after Freddie's death. Murphy also released a statement on behalf of his office and the Gray family. Quote, "We believe the police are keeping the circumstances of Freddie's death secret until they develop a version of events that will absolve them of all responsibility. However, his family and the citizens of Baltimore deserve to know the real truth, and we will not stop until we get justice for Freddie." Unfortunately, Murphy never shared what information he allegedly had to contradict the police timeline. Murphy eventually negotiated the $6.4 million civil settlement between the city of Baltimore and the Gray family that was signed in September 2015. Murphy and the Gray family have been mostly quiet since, save for a few carefully orchestrated public statements during the police officers' trials and following the state's attorney's decision to drop the remaining charges last summer. Prior to this podcast's debut, we made repeated attempts to contact Murphy, alerting him and the family to our investigation and to request interviews, but we haven't heard back. At their first press conference on the afternoon of April 13th, Baltimore police would only say that the still unnamed prisoner had suffered an injury and was in, quote, medical distress, but declined to elaborate. Later that evening, Richard Shipley, Freddie's stepfather, told the Baltimore Sun just how serious the 25-year-old's condition actually was, saying that he was in a medically induced coma after suffering three or more broken vertebrae. 2 days later, Baltimore Sun reporter Colin Campbell wrote a follow-up story with information gleaned from a one-on-one interview with Shipley, who told him that Freddie had undergone, quote, double surgery on three broken vertebrae and an injured voice box. According to Shipley, the Sun reported, doctors had told the Gray family that Freddie had gone without oxygen for a time, but did not sustain a brain injury in the encounter. At that point, according to the report, Freddie was in critical condition, but his prognosis was not without hope. Quote, "He's doing a little better, I guess," Shipley told the Sun. "The operations went as well as could be expected. They won't know until he wakes up." Shipley's claims about Freddie's injuries are contradicted by the autopsy in a couple key ways. According to Assistant Medical Examiner Dr. Carol Allen, who conducted the autopsy and was a key prosecution witness at the trials, Freddie's larynx and hyoid bone were both intact, and there's no indication that the area had been surgically repaired. According to both Dr. Allen and doctors at Shock Trauma, Freddie did suffer from a brain injury, though not from head trauma during the encounter, but from going without oxygen after he stopped breathing. The autopsy notes brain edema to primarily the parietal and occipital lobes, as well as the medulla of the brainstem. In layman's terms, the top and rearmost portions of Freddie's brain were swollen, as was the lower part of the brainstem, which connects with the spinal cord. Dr. Allen's autopsy report doesn't offer any indication or estimation of how long Freddie went without breathing, and throughout the trials, the various medical experts sort of skirted around the issue. They debated whether the injury would have caused him to stop breathing gradually or immediately. They discussed in general terms what a lack of oxygen does to the brain, but they carefully sidestepped any discussion of just how long Freddie was without oxygen. Coming up with an exact number of minutes is impossible, but that shouldn't have stopped the experts from estimating based on the available information. Because breathing is important, right? Without oxygen, the brain begins to die, and it takes just 3 minutes for irreversible brain damage to occur. And we can estimate how long, based on the sworn statements of the officers present at stop six at the station, the fire department incident reports, which tell us when the emergency responders arrived at the scene, and the testimony and pre-hospital care report filled out by the paramedic. Under close scrutiny, the evidence makes it extremely difficult to believe that Freddie Gray could have survived on April 12th. Stop tugging at your bra straps and second-guessing your size. It's time to put fit first with Third Love. Third Love uses women's real measurements and super smoothing memory foam to create bras that fit better and are more comfortable. I love that many of Third Love's bra styles, including their t-shirt and push-up bras, come in multiple nude shades so that women of all skin tones are represented. They offer sizes from AA to G, as well as their exclusive half-cup sizes. Just answer a few simple questions online, and Third Love will recommend a bra in the right size and style for you. Best of all, you can try before you buy. Having endured it a few times myself, I can attest to the awkwardness of in-store bra fittings. At home, you can actually see how the bra looks under various outfits. There's seriously nothing more annoying than realizing after it's too late that your new strapless bra totally shows under the dress you plan to wear to a friend's wedding. Take it from the woman who did bridesmaid duty with band-aids over her nipples. And now Third Love is offering you a chance to try one of their perfect 24/7 bras free for 30 days. Just pay $2.99 for shipping and you're on your way to a perfect fit. You'll get to really live in this bra. Feel free to wash it, wear it all day. You might even forget that you're wearing it. If Third Love isn't your favorite bra, just return or exchange it for free. Go to thirdlove.com/undisclosed now to get your perfect Third Love bra and try it for 30 days. That's thirdlove.com/undisclosed to try your new favorite bra for free. thirdlove.com/undisclosed. Back in episode 7, we told you that a medic was not immediately dispatched to the Western District Station upon request, at least according to the police dispatched audio played at trial and the timestamps on the publicly available fire department dispatch audio. This delay was first revealed by Jane Miller of WBAL on April 24, 2015, prompting a fire department spokesperson to issue a short, vague statement about dispatcher confusion. Regardless of the cause, the Baltimore City Fire Department's delay in sending a medic made Freddie Gray's prognosis significantly worse. I wish I could say their apparent culpability ends there, but absolutely everything about the documentation available for Freddie's pre-hospital care is a mess. According to the police dispatch audio, Goodson and the transport van arrived at the Western District Station at 9:18 and 40 seconds. Dante Allen was unloaded from the left side of the van and brought inside the station by Officer Zachary Novak. Novak testified that he spent about 5 minutes inside, allegedly beginning the process of making Allen a CI, or a confidential informant. By the time Novak went back outside to where Goodson was waiting by the van, Officer William Porter had arrived, and all three were present when Freddie Gray was discovered, as Novak put it, unconscious inside. According to the police dispatch audio, Novak called for a medic at 9:24 and 58 seconds. So it's safe to assume that Freddie was found at approximately 9:24. According to their statements and testimony, Novak and Porter did not check to see if Freddie was breathing, and Novak's request for an ambulance refers to Freddie as having lost consciousness. Medic 43 arrived on scene at 9:34, and the EMTs were with the patient at 9:36. Paramedic Angelique Herbert and her partner that day, EMT Thurman White, were working a peak medic, or a 12-hour shift from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Because of that whole dispatcher confusion, they were told to expect a patient with a broken arm, but Herbert took one look at Freddie and realized he wasn't breathing and in cardiac arrest. Herbert alerted fire dispatch that the man with the broken arm was actually in far more serious condition and requested an engine company and an EMS officer. All three units would have been dispatched at the time of the original call if it had been reported correctly. Engine 8 arrived first at 9:40 a.m. and was driven by firefighter and pump operator Dwayne Brown and manned by at least two EMTs, Joseph Greeley and Patrick Reed. Medic 15, the ambulance that responded to North Avenue to treat the man with the injured arm, it operates out of the Engine 8 fire station, by the way. Both the fire department and the police department use computer automated dispatch systems, or CAD systems, which keep track of all their activity. According to the CAD report for this emergency call, EMS 3 was also dispatched at approximately the same time as Engine 8, and that unit responded that they were en route. A little over a minute later, EMS 3 cleared. That is, they were no longer en route to the station. According to the CAD report, whoever cleared the unit was unknown and not logged into their usual account, which would have displayed their ID number. Odd, right? Ultimately, EMS-2 was dispatched and en route about 4 minutes after Angelique Herbert requested additional backup. Lieutenant James Irons arrived at the station at 9:47 a.m. after Freddie had already been loaded into the ambulance and was being given CPR. Freddie was given continuous CPR all the way into the emergency room and shocked by the defibrillator twice. By the time he was admitted into shock trauma, he had a pulse, but it was weak. In addition to treating Freddie at the scene and transporting him to the emergency room, Herbert was also responsible for filling out a pre-hospital care report detailing all of the medical treatments Freddie received before he was admitted to shock trauma, complete with 2-second timestamps for each. This is, or at least should be, valuable documentation of the severity of Freddie's condition shortly after he was discovered. There's just one massive problem. The timestamps are wrong. Like, way wrong. Glaringly, undeniably, infuriatingly wrong. At least based on everything else we've been told. For example, by all accounts, none of the officers gave Freddie CPR. Yet under the cardiac arrest data section of the pre-hospital care report, the time of first CPR is noted as 9:30, before Medic 43 had arrived at the station. CPR is mentioned a few more times on the report, but with drastically different timestamps. Under the section labeled narrative, Herbert wrote that after Freddie was transferred to a backboard and stretcher, she bagged his airway with a BV mask, performed an endotracheal intubation, and then started CPR at 10:20 and 48 seconds. CPR is listed for a third time and also given a timestamp of 10:20 a.m. The timestamps for all the other treatments and procedures on this report, including defibrillation, spinal immobilization, and blood glucose analysis, are after 10:17 a.m. According to the fire department, Freddie was admitted to shock trauma at 10 a.m. At Officer Goodson's trial, Herbert testified that she filled out the report after transporting Freddie to the hospital. This is standard procedure, as caring for patients supersedes filling out paperwork. The times are estimated, Herbert said, and she acknowledged that the timing on her report was not an accurate reflection of when the treatments actually occurred. Quote, "It's kind of hard to pinpoint the time of when you actually gave the specific care to the patient," she explained. But because no specific timestamps were ever referenced by her or any of the attorneys, the level of inaccuracy was never revealed. When Herbert testified at the Porter trial in front of a jury, the prosecution didn't even address the timing issue at all. A discrepancy of a few minutes is to be expected when estimating timestamps after the fact. But 40 to 45 minutes on a medical report pertaining to a patient who needed advanced life support? Dr. Lee Lavati, who should be a familiar name to listeners of Undisclosed First Season, is the Deputy Chief Medical Examiner at the Wayne County Medical Examiner's Office and an Assistant Professor of Pathology at the University of Michigan. Dr. Lavati has reviewed the autopsy of Freddie Gray and the medical testimony in this case, which we'll get to shortly. I also asked her to take a look at Herbert's report and drew her attention to the timestamp issue.
You were the one who pointed out the actual timing of when the attempts at resuscitation by the medics were noted. And I know that, you know, they don't do it at the time, you know, they're busy resuscitating, and these reports are usually filled out once they're turned over to the care in the ER. So I think you could expect a little time leeway because maybe they don't know exactly what time. But since you pointed that out, I started in my recent cases here looking at the EMS reports and comparing it to the ER reports, and I did not find a single one with such a discrepancy in the time. So I have no explanation for why the time seemed to be so off from what we think we know with the sequence when he arrived at the station and then when he arrives at the actual hospital.
The timing isn't the only questionable thing about Herbert's pre-hospital care report, some of which her own trial testimony contradicts. For example, Herbert was questioned by the defense about her decision to give Freddie Narcane, a drug given to patients in cases where a suspected overdose is possible. While this is not at all unusual, especially when treating patients who are unconscious, Herbert's report states, quote, "Client was arrested for suspected drug possession, so possible drug ingestion or overdose was treated." Herbert did not offer this explanation when questioned at trial, so it's not clear if her report was accurate, and if so, which officer told her that Freddie was arrested for drug possession.
Well,
Herbert provided one of the most visceral descriptions of Freddie's neck injury in her trial testimony. Quote, "I felt just the midline, and it wasn't firm. It was more crumbly," she said at the Porter trial. "It wasn't firm, like if you could just run your hand back there. It wasn't firm at all back there." She told detectives something similar when she was interviewed on April 23rd, but there's no indication on her initial report that she noticed anything wrong with Freddie's neck or spine. In the section labeled assessment exam, both neck and cervical are noted as being normal. Within this grab bag of discrepancies in the pre-hospital care report, there are details that favor and disfavor both the prosecution and the defense, which likely explains why each side focused on the more mundane details rather than using it to their advantage. My list of questions that only the Baltimore City Fire Department can answer grows longer by the day, but they've refused to comment on anything related to Freddie Gray. At the very top of the list remains the most important question of all. How long did he go without oxygen? That's a question that's impossible to answer in exact terms in this case, but even estimating a range is difficult without knowing for certain when he first stopped breathing and when he first received CPR. The autopsy report conducted by Dr. Carol Allen assumes that Freddie was not breathing when he was found at the station, and this variable went unchallenged by the defense experts at trial. That's not a surprise. Their theory depends on that assumption. In fact, every defense expert said that their conclusion was that Freddie had suffered his neck injury after stop five, but before arriving at the district. The injury was so catastrophic, they testified, that Freddie's ability to breathe would have been immediately and severely affected. Dr. Joel Weiner, a neurosurgeon who testified at Officer Goodson's trial, said Freddie would have stopped breathing within seconds. The state's theory that Freddie's injury was progressive allows for some flexibility, but the defense experts were clear. Freddie had stopped breathing by the time the van arrived at the station, so we can estimate about 9:19 a.m. As for when Freddie received CPR, the best guess I can make is based on what Herbert noted in her report. As noted earlier, Engine 8 arrived at Western District at 9:40 a.m. Because the pre-hospital care report has left us with no other option but to estimate, let's assume that CPR began at 9:39 a.m. In other words, what the defense medical experts didn't articulate was that their theory of a catastrophic injury between stop 5 and stop 6 meant that Freddie Gray was not breathing for at least 20 minutes. The brain begins to die after 3 minutes without oxygen. After 10 minutes, death is likely. After 15 minutes, it's almost certain. But 20 minutes? To survive that long is miraculous. But miracles don't play so well in a court of law, especially when arguing over likely outcomes.
A couple of years ago, I was visiting my relatives in Pakistan, and I bought this gorgeous piece of art that was hammered metal and paint. And I kind of lugged it around for 2 years, not sure about how to frame it or how to display it because it's got mixed mediums and it was kind of an unconventional size and shape. And then I found Framebridge. Framebridge is an amazing service that allows you to frame your art from the comfort of your home. And instead of paying hundreds that you would pay at a store, their prices start at only $39, plus all the shipping is free. Framebridge has a frame for every style, from clean and classic to more eclectic. I got my artwork matted in this beautiful clean white with a nice silver frame, and they use premium wood moldings, acid-free mat boards and foam boards, and their acrylic glazing never shatters and it protects your piece from harmful UV rays. The expert team at Framebridge will custom frame your item in days, not weeks or months, and they deliver it to your door ready to hang. And they offer a happiness guarantee. Each team gives every personal item care and attention because meeting your expectations is as important as meeting their own. So now, all of those photos you have lying around, the art you have rolled up in your closet that's been waiting for you to put in a nice frame, it's your chance to get them framed. Because if you're an undisclosed listener, you get 15% off your first order at framebridge.com when you use the code undisclosed. Get started framing today. Frame your photos or art. Go to framebridge.com and use the promo code undisclosed to save an additional 15% off your first order. Just go to framebridge.com and use the promo code undisclosed. I'm going to be tweeting out my beautiful piece of art so you can see exactly what Framebridge did for me.
The prosecution's case, especially against officers Goodson, Porter, and White, was almost entirely dependent on Dr. Carol Allen's autopsy and testimony. And Dr. Allen had concluded that Freddie Gray was injured after he had been reloaded into the van at stop 2 and before Goodson arrived at stop 4. The state argued that Porter, Goodson, and White were well aware of Freddie's need for medical attention and did not provide it immediately. The medical experts who testified at trial and the two experts we've consulted with agree with Dr. Allen's assessment of Freddie's neck injury based on the MRI and CT scans that were done at the hospital on April 12th. In addition to Dr. Lavati, I've also consulted with Dr. Adam Lipson, a private practice neurosurgeon with 5 offices between New York and New Jersey. Educated at Dartmouth and Harvard universities, Dr. Lipson did research on spinal cord injuries in Sweden under a Fulbright scholarship and trained at the University of Washington and Penn State Hershey. His practice focuses on complex spine surgery as well as functional spinal cord surgery. In his career, he's performed 3,000 spine surgeries, 1,500 of which were neck surgeries. And the spine injury he sees most frequently in his practice is the one sustained by Freddie Gray. So I'll let him explain.
His major injuries are a C4-5 set dislocation, a spinal cord injury, and a left vertebral artery injury that led to a cardiovascular collapse, coma, and anoxic brain death. And that's kind of to summarize. It also caused paralysis for him. This is a fairly common injury, and usually you see this from car accidents. Mm-hmm. And it's usually someone who hits their roof or hits a window with their head flexed. And it's usually some sort of flexion with right. some sort of axial loading or compression of the spine. Occasionally it could be with a rotation if it's a unilateral set injury. So the head must have been turned one direction with the head right. flexed and hit like the back of his head and pushed the spine out of alignment. It does take a lot of force to make that occur.
Dr. Lipson also invited me to his office on Manhattan's Upper East Side to take a look at some images of neck and spinal cord injuries. We still don't have the MRI and CT scans that were taken of Freddie's spine, so Dr. Lipson's assessment of his injury is based on the information detailed in the autopsy report, the description and opinions of Dr. Allen and the medical experts, and his experience as a practicing neurosurgeon.
So here's kind of your classic jumped facet joint. All right. And what we see here is this is what a normal cervical spine looks like. Mm-hmm. This is a C2, C3, C4, C5 vertebral bodies. You see the facet joints right there. Okay. They're kind of stacked along that, and it allows the spine to maintain motion. What you see here is this facet joint has actually jumped over the other facet joint. See how it's kind of wrapped like this?
Yeah.
But at this level, it's like there isn't forward.
So there's not that gap there?
Correct. Okay. And this gap is where the spinal cord runs.
Okay.
So that completely cuts off it compresses the spinal cord. And you can see that disc space that's normally open, you see how it's shifted off the disc space.
Yeah.
It's pulled off the ligaments.
The spinal cord at the C4, C5 level has a direct connection to the diaphragm, which is needed for both breathing and speech. Freddie's ability or inability to do both hinges on the damage caused to his spinal cord when the jump facet fracture occurred. It's impossible to know for sure, but experts are paid to have opinions within a reasonable degree of medical certainty. In this case, their assessment of the immediate damage to Freddie's spinal cord directly correlates to their opinion on when and even how the injury occurred based on the circumstances provided. And therein lies the rub. The circumstances of Freddie Gray's arrest and transport, the timeline of the van's 6 stops, and the descriptions of his behavior at each have over the course of this podcast been seriously called into question. But they are all Dr. Allen and the other medical experts had to work with. The narrative laid out in the autopsy report was drawn directly from the Baltimore Police Department's investigation, including the recollections of the detectives investigating the case, and the recorded statements from officers Nero, Miller, Rice, White, Porter, and Novak, or 5 out of the 6 defendants. Not a single civilian witness statement was given to Dr. Allen. While the police department usually is tasked with providing such investigatory materials to the medical examiner, In this case, it was the state's attorney's office who chose and provided the witness statements to Dr. Allen. Witnesses are often also suspects, so it's perfectly reasonable and correct that the defendant's statements would be included. But allowing their statements to inform the entire narrative in which Freddie was injured, when multiple bystanders were also interviewed by detectives and might have shared information the officers wouldn't dare.
It's clear from the autopsy report that Dr. Allen ruled out an injury at stop one based on seeing at least a portion of Kevin Moore's cell phone footage. Freddie, quote, exhibited both verbal and some physical resistance, Dr. Allen wrote, bearing weight on his legs and actively speaking. She also wrote, it is reported that Mr. Gray could be heard yelling and banging, causing the van to rock, she noted. Only Officer Novak reported that claim at stop one. Dr. Allen also ruled out an injury at stop two, down on Baker and Mount Streets, because Freddie was still, quote, yelling and shaking the van and reportedly still verbally and physically active after being shackled and put back inside. While reviewing the cell phone footage taken by Brandon Ross at stop two, she described it all as confusing. She testified at the trial of Lieutenant Brian Rice. Well, it was not professionally filmed and it was blurry, she said. And actually, I could not see what was actually going on. And it was mostly then from the officer's statements about what was actually going on at that stop. Remember, in episode 4, we told you all that banging and shaking served a very specific purpose, establishing that Freddie was alive and well before the van left Gilmore Homes. At trial, the prosecution questioned those details, even showing footage from Cam 2A, which showed the van staying perfectly still. The autopsy concluded that Freddie was injured inside the van, between the second and fourth stops, and, quote, possibly before the third stop, when a video showed the driver stopping, getting out, and looking in the back of the van. Dr. Allen was referring, of course, to the corner store surveillance video, which doesn't have a date or a timestamp, which shows an unidentifiable driver stopping an unidentifiable police van and getting out to do something at the rear of the van that we can't actually see. As we told you in episode 6, the prosecution suggested that Goodson's wide right turn onto Fremont Street just before stop 3 was indicative of a rough ride. Their theory was that Freddie had gotten up from his position on the floor of the wagon and was caught off guard by the van's turn. Restrained at the hands and feet, he was unable to maintain his balance, falling and hitting his head in such a way that his neck fractured. It wasn't in the defense's interest to challenge the idea that Freddie could have fallen and broken his neck while the van was in motion. It was their theory, too, after all, only they argued that the fall was accidental and happened between stops 5 and 6. However, their experts argued that Freddie's neck fracture was too serious to have occurred so early in the van's route, because he wouldn't have been able to breathe, speak, or move by the time the van arrived at stop 4, let alone at stop 5. These accounts of Freddie's speaking and moving are, of course, straight out of the defendant's statements. Interestingly, it was the way Freddie was speaking and moving that led Dr. Allen to conclude he was already injured by stop 4. Here's her exchange with prosecutor Janice Bledsoe at the Porter trial. Bledsoe. Now, what physical symptoms, as described by Officer Porter, led you to that conclusion? Dr. Allen. I need help. I can't breathe. I can't move. And responding yes to do I need a medic? At stop 5, up on North Avenue, Dr. Allen learned through Porter and Sergeant White's witness statements that Freddie was found kneeling on the floor, wedged between the bench and the wall, and slumped forward. She testified that she was later told that someone else, though she didn't say who, said Freddie was leaning rather than slumped. This didn't change her opinion, however. Even if paralyzed, the tight dimensions of the van could have kept Freddie upright, whether he was slumped or leaning. As she said, if someone is paralyzed, if you put them in a position or he's in a position, he'll stay there until gravity is going to move him. And he would still have muscular control of his neck and his head, shoulders even, maybe even the tops of his shoulders. So no, it doesn't surprise me, given the constraints of that van, that he could have been on the bench with an injury and then end up in a kneeling position, with leaning.
Teach, write, podcast, travel, sleep, rinse, repeat. My days and weeks can get super busy. So when I do something, I have to multitask. That's why I'm glad I discovered Blue Apron. With Blue Apron, I don't have to worry about scheduling trips to the supermarket. I simply log on to my account and choose my meals, and then voila. I get fresh ingredients from over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the U.S., delivered right to my house. And in 40 minutes or less, I can whip up a creative meal for myself, and Blue Apron creates instant family time. And I get to pick up some new kitchen skills. With Blue Apron's easy-to-follow recipe cards, I can up my blanching, braising, searing, and sautéing game. So in less than an hour, I'm cooking, I'm learning, and I'm reconnecting with the people I love. This week, I've got some squid ink spaghetti and shrimp to cook up, and I can't wait to try some of the upcoming meals, like the crispy salmon with a roasted potato salad, pickled mustard seed creme fraiche sauce, and the vegetarian-friendly three-cheese baby broccoli stromboli with tomato and oregano dipping sauce. And get this, you can go a whole year without repeating an item. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Dante Allen's statement to detectives about hearing Freddie banging his head on the other side of the van between stop 5 and stop 6 was not given to Dr. Allen, but she was told about it and notes it in her autopsy report. At trial, she explained that the substance of his statement was conveyed to her by both members of the police department and the state's attorney's office. Quote, "I mean, I heard it from at least 5 or 6 different people, and they told me it in exactly the same words," Dr. Allen testified. "So I didn't feel that it was necessary for me to actually sit down and watch Mr. Allen say exactly the same thing." Dante Allen has since backtracked on his original statement, but Angelique Herbert's pre-hospital care report notes that the officers told her they, quote, heard Freddie banging his head on the way to the station. In her statement to detectives on April 23rd and again at trial, she indicated Officer Novak had shared that detail. But Novak wasn't the only officer pushing the theory that Freddie hurt himself. EMT Irons indicated to detectives on April 28th that both Novak and Officer Porter said they heard Freddie banging his head. Lieutenant Rice's statement to detectives is the most interesting of all. According to the detective's notes, quote, "Rice was told by his officers that when Officer Goodson got to the station, the prisoner was lethargic." That's a word Officer Porter would go on to use multiple times. Noted. Rice also said that he was told, quote, "Freddie was seated on the floor of the wagon and he didn't look good." Rice said that Goodson told him directly that Freddie was, quote, "hitting his head in the wagon, and when the medics got there, he was unresponsive." So, could Freddie have been trying to injure himself? According to Dr. Lipson, this is not only extremely unlikely, but also unsupported by the medical evidence.
Like, if somebody's, you know, sitting in a metal van and they're banging their head, can you give yourself this injury?
No, not that level of force. Yeah. Not without significant head injuries, contusions, scalp injuries. I mean, I've seen people bang their heads into, you know, but normally you don't bang your head into a neck injury of that magnitude. You usually bang your head and causing brain injuries or skull fractures.
Although all of the experts agreed with Dr. Allen's assessment of the jump facet fracture of the C4-C5 vertebrae, they were at odds over the damage to Freddie Gray's spinal cord in the immediate aftermath. The exact nature of Freddie's injury wasn't known until hours after the fact, when the doctors at Shock Trauma reviewed the CT scan and MRI of Freddie's spine. Whether those tests reflect the gravity of his injury at the time it occurred is what's up for debate. A CT scan was performed approximately 1 hour after Freddie was admitted to shock trauma at 11 a.m. But it was the MRI which revealed the full scope of the damage to Freddie's spinal cord, and that wasn't performed until 3:15 in the afternoon, 6 or so hours after the injury allegedly occurred. Both Dr. Allen and the prosecution's other medical expert, neurosurgeon Dr. Morris Mark Soriano, discussed the differences that can emerge when comparing the MRI findings with the actual anatomy, in this case, Freddie Gray's actual cervical spine. Quote, CTs or MRIs are much better at some things, or for some things, better than autopsies, and autopsies are better than the CTs or scans for other things, Dr. Allen testified. And this is one of them. It appeared on a scan that there was a near transection of Mr. Gray's spinal cord. At autopsy, it was not transected. It was pinched. They read it as a transection, she said. But that's not the injury that we found, because he was not transected. Dr. Lipson found this part of the testimony especially interesting.
You know, I was fascinated when they talked about transection. Transections are really rare, really unusual of a spinal cord. Normally, those are penetrating injuries, like someone shoots you in the neck or in the back. Or someone puts a knife through you. You're not going to get a transection generally from these types of fracture and what we call contusion type injuries. And the autopsy report sustained that.
A contusion or bruise directly to the spinal cord would have caused it to swell. Quote, the tissues and the cells of the spinal cord are exquisitely sensitive to a lack of oxygen and glucose, Dr. Soriano testified at Porter's trial. And lack of blood, obviously. So if you swell the spinal cord, the blood supply can't get to the tiny little areas inside the spinal cord because there's so much swelling. The body just doesn't have enough power to push the blood and the oxygen and the glucose to those tissues. And they're very, very sensitive to the lack of oxygen and glucose, and they die. Dr. Lipson's experience treating patients with incomplete cervical spine fractures has shown that they very often become progressively worse, causing a secondary injury to the spinal cord.
With incomplete injuries, yes, they found a lot of damage in the spinal cord at autopsy, but remember, he had gone through a cardiac arrest at that point. He had been hypoperfused, and you see spinal cord injuries often evolve over several days to several weeks to expand. It's not an all or nothing thing. Oftentimes, what we see is, listen, you could have a fracture, then you don't immobilize the neck, you sit a person upright, and as that fracture falls into a dislocation and poor alignment, or, you know, it's progressively compressing the spinal cord until the spinal cord just stops working as the blood flow is poor. So you could see a progressive injury over this time frame. It's not an acute, like, that's certainly within the realm of possibility. But generally, the forces here are quite significant. You know, it's really got to be a sort of a single hard trauma to the neck rather than multiple traumas to cause this type of injury. And the question is, well, could you breathe and maintain an airway after this? I mean, you could, but you probably lose it as your diaphragm. You know, as your spinal cord starts swelling, you lose use of your arms and legs and your diaphragm progressively. It is possible for you to talk, you know, with a cervical spinal cord injury. You know, unfortunately, it's quite a devastating thing. I saw a woman with a similar injury who was screaming. Had C4-5 injury complete, couldn't move her arms or legs.
Whoa.
And obviously, it was horrifying to witness. It was horrifying for her. It was one of those things you never forget.
This variability in how these injuries progress and manifest symptoms that makes it extremely difficult to judge when the fatal trauma occurred.
You could be talking right after the cord injury.
Mm-hmm.
You could say, oh, I can't feel my legs, I can't feel my arms. And as the cords swell, then you have trouble breathing.
Okay.
So that's certainly feasible. It's not like you just get one injury and then all of a sudden, I mean, it happens, but normally it's not always an all or nothing thing. You can get an injury to the spinal cord, you develop swelling, and then you get progressive deficit with that swelling.
So do you think that this, I mean, I guess you can't really say for sure without seeing it, but based on the description by the medical examiner, does it sound to you like he could have, like, how long would it have been before his spinal cord swelled to the point where he, like, lost consciousness?
That one's very unpredictable. I've seen it over 15, 20 minutes. I've seen it over a few hours.
Really?
Yeah. So
does it ever happen immediately? Because that was one of the, that's what...
I have seen it immediately as well. So, and that's always the variability with these types of injuries, because they're all kind of incomplete injuries, but they can progress. Especially if you have an unprotected spine. Say you got an acute fracture. Okay. The trauma happens. You don't have cervical precautions, or you're not in a collar, you're not immobilized. All of a sudden the spine gets gradually a little more unstable, and the low function you have progresses or gets lost.
Right.
So that's why, you know, oftentimes you get an incomplete injury, it progresses complete. I've seen people with spinal cord injuries, you know, they get fracture of their neck, trouble moving their hands, and all of a sudden an hour later they can't use their hands at all.
Yeah.
So we see that.
The narrative accepted by both the prosecution and the defense was essentially what happened happened inside the van. By ruling out an injury before Freddie was loaded and locked inside the van, where no person or camera could be a witness, how the actual neck fracture occurred was left to speculation. The experts assessed Freddie's behavior and condition after stop two, which led to their dueling conclusions on when the injury occurred, and only then did they speculate as to how it happened. But if there is too much variability in how jump facet fractures and spinal cord injuries progress and manifest their systems to reach a conclusion on the timing, as Dr. Lipson suggests, then maybe the reverse can tell us more. What are the various options for the mechanism of injury, and is any one more plausible than the others? All of the experts, including Dr. Lipson and Dr. Levati, agree that for this or for any jump facet fracture to occur, there needs to be a high energy impact to the head. In Freddie's case, his head was flexed and also rotated. According to the autopsy, there was no external trauma to his head, except for a small laceration on the left temple and a small abrasion on the right temple, likely from the cervical collar used to stabilize his neck in the hospital. But when the scalp was reflected during autopsy, there was a subscalp hematoma, or collection of clotted blood, on, quote, the lateral aspect of the left side of the back of the head, just superior to the neck region. This is the only major injury to Freddie's head, and almost certainly the point of impact.
When the scalp was reflected, there was an obvious impact site on sort of the left back of the head. So that was assumed to be the point of impact, because there really was no other impact site on the head. And for a impact to cause this type of injury, it would have to be a pretty forceful impact. So it seems that when he probably was already having his head down and turned to the side, but then the force that was applied was pretty strong and actually then sort of drove his head down and turned it slightly so that the neck had no other option but to go in that position and then end up breaking and jumping and locking facets because of that force. And for it to not have an external injury, this would mean that a sort of smooth surface, that when the force was applied, this was to a smooth surface. If this was like a roughened surface like pavement, or if there are any projections in the actual surface, this sort of impact would have caused injuries to the skin. But if it's like a smooth, basically a wall, something that would be smooth, and it was a strong enough force, it could leave no injury on the outside of your head, but underneath your scalp, that's where we would see where the actual impact was.
Fractures like this are most common in car accidents, and the mechanism itself is similar to what can happen in a multi-car pileup. Imagine three cars speeding down a single-lane highway close together when the first car slams suddenly into a wall. The second car slams into the first, But when the third car makes impact, it's with such force that it keeps going and ends up on top of the car in front of it. That's basically what happened to Freddie's cervical spine at the C4, C5 level when his head was slammed into something. Let's start with Goodson's rolling right turn and whether it could have resulted in a fall that would produce Freddie's neck injury, as was the state's contention.
It's feasible.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, yeah, unlikely at that velocity, unless they were doing like a 40 mile an hour sudden stop or something. These are high velocity injuries, and usually they're high. They're that definition, I think, is a 35 mile an hour minimum mm-hmm. for a high velocity injury.
Like the defense experts at trial, Dr. Levati questioned the likelihood that Freddie would end up falling back into the same position he started in when the van left stop two. Remember, he was reloaded after being shackled and placed on the floor of the wagon, belly down, with his head facing the front.
I just don't believe that he's going to get up on his knees, have the injury, and then fall exactly back down prone or lying on his belly. Like, why wouldn't he fall on his side? Why wouldn't
right.
he just be slumped over? I just don't believe that the injury could have occurred just from a mechanic point of view.
We, of course, have serious doubts about whether stop three or even stop four happened based on the lack of evidence. But we do know that the transport van ended up at stop five up on North Avenue at some point, and allegedly with Freddie inside. Regardless of its route, the van was in transit for a period of time, and we have no idea how Goodson was driving. While that rolling right turn just before stop three wasn't very convincing, we can't rule out the possibility that at some point, off camera, or at least not on the footage that was released publicly, Goodson was driving at a speed that, upon coming to a sudden stop, might have caused Freddie to fall and break his neck. But when you consider how many doubts we have about the official narrative, there are a lot of scenarios that could have resulted in this injury, including scenarios where Freddie could have been injured outside the van. We just don't know. What we do know is that at stop one, multiple witnesses reported seeing Officer Miller put his knee into Freddie's neck with the full force of his weight. According to Seth Stoughton, a former police officer and current assistant professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, it's common for the police to use both their knee and shin to hold down an arrestee while they're handcuffing them. However, the proper way to apply this technique is to the center of the back, evenly distributing their weight. The goal is to prevent the prone person from moving for as long as it takes to get them in handcuffs. Simply bearing down into someone's neck with a knee wouldn't accomplish that goal and could be quite painful. But a knee in Freddie's neck, even for a sustained period of time, could not have caused his fatal neck injury. Here's Dr. Levati to explain.
I did not believe that the knee on the back of the neck could have created this particular fracture. Even if Freddie had his head down and turned to the side, a knee to the back of the neck was not going to be the force to create this jump facet type of fracture. It simply is just a different or wrong type of force.
While it's possible that the knee in Freddie's neck could have injured him in some other way, there would be no way to tell from looking at the imaging scans or anatomy after the fatal injury occurred. The ultimate damage to his vertebrae and spinal cord was too great to parse out whether multiple injuries occurred back to back. Think of it like a vase with a big crack down the side. If that vase drops to the ground from 10 feet in the air and shatters, you wouldn't be able to tell it had previously been cracked. We've also wondered if an earlier injury, like at stop one, would have made Freddie more susceptible to the fatal injury a little while later. To continue with the analogy, does a crack make a vase more likely to break if it's dropped? Possibly, in the sense that a crack is a weakness in the vase's structure. But a vase that is dropped from 10 feet is going to shatter no matter what. Not having a crack wouldn't make the vase less susceptible to shattering. The same can be said about Freddie's neck. Previously injured or not, a high-energy impact was going to cause his jump facet fracture regardless. As for Freddie's limp legs as he was dragged to the van, this was very likely the result of having been held down on a leg lace for an extended period of time.
Yeah, that position could very easily sort of impinge the nerves and or the blood flow to his legs so that basically it would be like his legs and feet fell asleep, kind of like when you're sitting there at the movie theater and your foot starts to go asleep. Once the officer was off him and then he was stood up, the nerve impulses and the blood flow would be restored. And so he likely would have that tingly leg feeling. So at least initially he probably for that first bit couldn't have put weight on his legs because he couldn't really feel them. But at least there, when toward the end, when he did put down his foot and bear some weight, he obviously then was getting more feeling to them. So that could be an explanation for why we saw the limp doll legs.
Stoughton says a leg lace isn't or shouldn't be a typical handcuffing restraint technique. And when used, it should only be for as long as necessary.
I would not describe a leg lace as a standard handcuffing technique. I would describe it as a technique that's used when there is some amount of resistance that officers are trying to overcome. I would not expect it to be a normal part of handcuffing a compliant subject, no. The thing about both the leg lace and the knee in the back is that they're supposed to be quickly used and then transitioned away from as soon as possible. You don't keep someone on their chest. Police training to avoid police positional asphyxia. Police training is you get them into that position, you get them out of that position as quickly as possible by rolling them onto their side and hopefully having them sit up or stand up soon.
Freddie was heard complaining that he couldn't breathe and reportedly asked for his inhaler. His breathing very likely could have been hindered by the foot chase, followed by the length of time he was held down on his stomach. But if Freddie had suffered from positional asphyxia or suffocation from an inability to breathe because of his position at stop one, it would have happened when he was down on the ground, not later. But that doesn't detract from the fact that being held in a leg lace for much longer than necessary is dangerous and dehumanizing. That Officer Miller, who was nearly twice his size, sat on Freddie while he was in this position even after he complained of not being able to breathe, and that Officer Nero, a trained EMT, didn't insist on sitting him up, shows their utter ambivalence to his health and well-being. To the best of our knowledge and the expertise of our medical experts, what occurred at stop one did not contribute to Freddie Gray's fatal injury, but the officer's actions certainly demonstrate that he was not safe in their care. What are you really hoping happens at the end of this? That's a question I've heard more than a few times over the course of making this podcast. The list is long, but if pressed to choose, my hope is probably for the most basic and unlikely of results. I want to know, and I want the rest of the world to know, what and or who killed Freddie Gray. The more we've learned about this case, the evidence, and his injury, the more I've had to grapple with the likelihood that we would not find a certain answer. That the prosecution's case, largely dependent on proving a theory based on speculation and weak evidence, is a depressing reflection of what I believe to be a successful cover-up. But that doesn't mean it was a perfect one. In addition to a large chunk of BPD's investigatory files, we also received over 200 photos taken by the crime lab, most of them on April 12th. There are pictures of Lieutenant Rice and Officers Miller, Nero, and Goodson. There's the outside of the transport van, including a few with the door open. The Gilmore Homes and Penn North area. Three Taser X26P stun guns and their cartridges. And 17 photos of Freddie Gray at Shock Trauma. On one hand, I'm extremely relieved that these latter photographs were taken. They offer the earliest visual evidence of Freddie's condition following his injury. On the other hand, they feel like yet another violation of his rights. A reminder of how he was dehumanized in life and in death. Freddie is comatose. There are tubes attached to his chest and a big fat tube passing through his swollen lips and down into his throat. He's wearing a neck brace to stabilize his spine. He's nude underneath the white hospital sheet, and in a few of the photos, the nurses have rolled him onto his side so that his backside can be documented. They're very intimate. There's a little blood under his nose. It still looks moist. On the top of his left shoulder, there's a fresh scrape about the size of a nickel. The exposed pink and red is stark against his black skin. The abrasion is noted in Dr. Allen's autopsy report, though it had started to heal by then. I sent the photo to Dr. Labate, who said that abrasions to the shoulders are, quote, very common in individuals who contact and scrape against pavement. Freddie couldn't have gotten the scrape from simply laying on the ground at stop one, she said. It would have required a fall or some other type of movement against the pavement. There's something else that jumped out at me right away. On Freddie's right leg, just below his kneecap, there are two distinct circular marks, each about the diameter of an unsharpened pencil. They're about an inch or so apart, and they look a lot like taser burns.
Shorty, that was after they tased the fuck out him like that. After they did tase Joe like that, you wonder why he can't use his legs.
On April 20th, the day after Freddie Gray died, Deputy Commissioner Jerry Rodriguez addressed the allegations that Freddie was tased by officers at Gilmore Homes.
The information we have is that Mr. Gray gave up without the use of force. There was an officer that was attempting to stop Officer Gray that took his taser out preparatory to using it, but never deployed the taser. That has been verified by downloading the information on the taser and also by the physical evidence on Mr. Gray's body, the lack of taser deployment.
Only three tasers had their information downloaded, the stun guns allegedly belonging to Lieutenant Rice and Officer Miller and Officer Goodson. The information from their tasers was downloaded to evidence.com, and the reports that were produced and added to the case file don't show any obvious sign of deployment on April 12th. Okie dokie. The cartridges themselves were all photographed with their blast doors face down, so I can't confirm that the serial number inside actually matches the officers' tasers. Honestly, I can't tell anything about the cartridges at all, including whether they're actually still loaded. There's also the fact that tasers can be used in a couple different ways. Probe mode can be used from a distance or up close, and when fired, unleashes the two taser darts and a flurry of wires held inside the cartridge. The spread between the two probes depends on the distance between the shooter and the target, but both probes need to hook onto the skin or clothing to work properly. When that happens, the taser gun's two electrodes send a series of extremely painful electrical pulses through the wires. The electricity can penetrate through 2 inches of clothing and causes immediate neuromuscular disruption. The brain is temporarily cut off from the body, and the target goes toppling to the ground and can no longer move. Drive stun mode, on the other hand, is what Taser calls its pain compliance option and requires that the active stun gun be pressed against the target's body. The probes are not deployed, and the cartridge doesn't even need to be installed. Instead, the two electrodes deliver a painful and direct shock. Because the electricity is localized, stun gun mode rarely results in neuromuscular disruption. When a taser is used in drive stun mode, it leaves behind a pair of burn marks the same approximate distance as the two electrodes. These burns can look a bit like small cigarette burns. But Freddie Gray was wearing jeans with sweatpants underneath, two layers that, according to Dr. Levati, could, quote, alter the appearance of the injury.
If a stun mode is used, you usually see two small dot, either abrasions or skin scrapes, bruises, or small burns. That would correspond to the two contacts on the device contacting the skin. So they would be very small injuries, but they would be characteristically very evenly spaced and would correlate to the actual weapon used.
Freddie was a very, very dark-skinned black man. And I sort of wonder if, like bruising, it's kind of harder to see, like visibly. Is that something that may have
That is entirely true. Really dark-skinned individuals, it's really hard to see bruising. It's also really hard to see the lividity in their bodies when we're trying to assess body position after death. Another possibility is if he had on clothing, if he had on multiple layers of clothing. The contact then is technically made with the clothing, and you can still get the painful stimulation from a stun mode, but that would certainly lessen any injuries that would be to your actual body. We're looking for tiny injuries that would be paired. So if any, and tiny, I mean, something that would be bigger than a pen tip, but not a whole lot bigger, but they would be paired and they would be equally spaced. And there was nothing in the autopsy report that was anywhere near that. I would not rule out that he hadn't been tased, particularly if he was wearing clothing and if it was multiple layers.
The possibility that Freddie was tased has been itching at me for a while. Brandon Ross described hearing the sound of the taser at Officer Nero's trial, even demonstrating that crackling. It's such a specific noise, unmistakable.
Then we got the police investigation files, and I realized just how many witnesses had told detectives that they actually witnessed Freddie being tased. The notes from these interviews are sparse and a little confusing, but the details are clear. Quote, the taser was pressed against the victim's body. The leads were not deployed, Tobias Sellers told detectives. Witness could hear the victim yelling for the police to stop. Dwayne Day said a, quote, redneck-type bike officer tased Freddie in the back after hitting him in the mouth and knocking him to the ground. He saw the hooks come out of the taser, detectives wrote in their notes. And at stop two, Day said, after Freddie was taken out of the van, the officers stood over top of him and tased him again. Kevin Moore was interviewed the afternoon of Freddie's arrest. He told detectives that he heard people shouting that his friend was being tased. When he first ran out onto Presbury Street, the notes say, Kevin could, quote, see the prongs stuck in Freddie's legs. Kevin also suggested that Freddie was tased at the second stop. He didn't see the officer use the taser there, but he could hear it, and it sounded like electricity. One of the officers removed it, he said, referring to the probe. Brandon Ross told investigators that an older white bike officer tased Freddie at stop one. And before he got to stop two, Brandon could not only hear Freddie yelling in pain, but the sound of the taser going off, the prong coming out, quote, like a bullet. Freddie's screams at stop two woke up Jamel Baker, and by the time he looked out the window, Freddie had gone quiet and still. But once he saw Brandon's video months later, he realized why Freddie had been screaming like he was in a horror movie.
The screams was like, the only way I can describe it is like if somebody was getting stabbed, like a Jason movie. You know how,
like crazy screaming.
Yeah, so he sounded like he was hurt. And then the day I went to the state's attorney's office, they had the video that Brandon was recording. Mm-hmm. So I finally realized what he was screaming for when they showed the video. Mm-hmm. And they was actually tasing him. That's why he was screaming like that.
Oh, you think he was they were tasing
they
him?
Were. They when were. When I seen the video, because I just knew he was screaming. I knew he was being hurt. And I just seen when they put him in the van. But when they showed me the video, they showed why he was screaming.
And you could tell? How could you tell he was being tased?
He was on the video, he was on his knees. And he, like, Brandon, he was over there, like, by that red car over there. So he was taking a video, but he kept saying, like, stop tasing him. Y'all already tased him up the street. Yeah. Why y'all take him out the van to tase him again?
Yeah.
The pair of round marks on Freddie's knee are subtle and not 100% conclusive, but they certainly make me wonder, not just about what else could have possibly caused them, but what other marks might have been on Freddie's body that went unnoticed or unnoted. Early on in my first interview with Dr. Lipson, before we really got into the particulars of the autopsy and medical testimony in this case, he said something that instantly grabbed my attention.
The only way I could see this happening without some sort of major car accident was if they shoved him into the van.
Dr. Allen ruled out a stop two injury based on all the banging and kicking Freddie was doing after being reloaded, at least according to the officer's statements. But witnesses have said the opposite. Freddie's screams, which grabbed their attention at stop one, also had them running down the street to stop two. But by the time they got there, the witnesses we spoke to said Freddie wasn't moving at all. The 20 or so seconds that Freddie is seen on Brandon Ross's cell phone video, motionless, his lower half draped over the bumper with his knees on the ground, contradicts the official narrative for this stop in a particularly damning way. So does Jacqueline Jackson, who was standing in her kitchen that morning when the van pulled up to the corner of Baker Street. She watched as Officer Goodson opened the back doors and Officer Nero, Officer Miller, and Lieutenant Rice pulled Freddie from the van, intending on shackling his feet. Freddie was pissed off, she said, and she watched as they handled him roughly, like he wasn't a human being. He got mouthy. They didn't like that.
I was in my kitchen cooking. I was cleaning up my kitchen. When I looked out the window, I seen them had Mr. Gray. The police had Mr. Gray and threw him up in the paddy wagon head first.
Like they bumped
the
head?
Yeah, they threw him up in there because all this was buckled and this was behind him.
Yeah.
I told them, what is y'all doing to that young man? They told me I need to mind my MFing business. And I told him, it is my MFing business. Why would y'all throw him up in their head first?
Did you hear a sound like you heard him hit?
Yeah, I hear something like, wow, like that. You know, you can hear because everybody was out on the street, but it wasn't loud, loud.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, the streets is real loud.
Yeah.
But you heard that.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you can hear him, you know, making noises like, you know, he's in pain.
Yeah.
And a person know when another person is in pain. But it's just sad.
Did you notice a reaction from the police officers after they did that?
They looked scared.
They realized?
Yeah, they looked scared. All of them looked scared. You know, after that happened, it was like they looked scared.
Yeah.
According to the detective's notes, both Kevin Moore and Brandon Ross gave similar accounts in their interviews on April 12th and April 13th. So did a woman named Sierra Warren, who heard Freddie screaming from her house on Mount Street. When she looked outside, she saw him lying face down. An officer picked him up, she said, and threw him into the back of the wagon. Dr. Lipson has not seen the MRI or CT scan himself, but should we eventually receive these records, he has promised to review them, and will share his insights with you. For now, his understanding of Freddie's fractured neck and spinal cord injury is, again, limited to how they're described in Dr. Allen's autopsy report, her testimony, and the testimonies of the other medical experts. His assessment of how that injury could have occurred, manifested its symptoms, and in what time frame is based on his experience as a neurosurgeon focused on the cervical spine, who treats patients with this injury more than any other.
But having, you know, say if his head was tilted or flexed and you push someone into a wall.
Right.
Where they're, if they don't have use of their hands to protect themselves.
So like if somebody was, let's say, handcuffed, leg shackled, and then picked up and thrown with force.
Yes.
Into, and they made their head made contact with a wall.
That would be the likely mechanism that would contribute to this type of injury.
Yep, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
There's one last thing. After the van left stop 2 with Freddie Gray inside, Brandon walked down to the Western District Police Station, just 4 blocks away. It was locked, and no one answered when he banged on the door repeatedly. Brandon went to a corner house right near the station and asked the lady who lived there if he could use her phone to call in his complaint instead. Across the street, the notes read, Brandon could see the transport van parked in the station's back lot.
Investigations can be tricky creatures. Much depends on who is doing the investigating, why they're doing it, and what they hope to achieve. And that's why different investigations into the same matter by different people can yield vastly different results, which means it's always good to have more than one set of eyes looking into an issue to figure out what actually happened. It's even better to have an independent body, one that's not connected with any party to the matter, investigate a case, allegation, or misdeed. Which is why it gets so very tricky, much trickier than usual, when a state has to investigate state officials. And it only gets more complicated, and some would argue, less reliable, when the police of all people have to investigate their own officers. Next time on Undisclosed.
Undisclosed, the Killing of Freddie Gray episode 11 was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marsha Chatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode. Methil Telehan produced and Saad Chaudhry consulted. We want to make sure that we give credit to Julie Myers, who helped out a ton by doing research for this episode. Thanks, Julie. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media. Our great sponsors this week were Third Love, Framebridge, and Blue Apron. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed's Webby Award-winning theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins for a discussion about this week's episode. Follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag FreddieGray and or the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then...